So I'm also delighted to be back here in Seattle and at Sims and see so many familiar faces. It's really a delight to see you all, and a very warm welcome to those of you who are new. So I want to just talk a little bit around the format of this weekend, because some of you are quite accustomed to the format that I've been using here over quite a few years now, which is different than just a silent sitting, walking practice weekend. And as I said last night, I'm always reluctant to use the word study, because people go into, you know, whip out their notebooks and their pens, and, you know, the mind can get a little sort of anxious about trying to remember everything, and everything is recorded, so you actually don't actually have to try and remember anything at all. The Buddha talked, you know, about three steps of insight. And he said that the first step of insight is to listen to the teachings. To listen to the teachings. The second step is to explore those teachings in your own experience. You know, do you have both intellectual and experiential agreement with what you've listened to? And the third step of insight, of course, is to embody those understandings. And each of those steps is equally important. First of all, listening to the teachings is one of the ways that we begin to question many of our assumptions, where we begin to explore the possibilities of seeing the world and seeing ourselves in new ways, where we begin to actually hear possibilities of awakening, of struggle ceasing. This hearing is often what sets us on a path. I found this very early on to be true in my own practice. You know, when I rolled up, you know, 17 years old in a Tibetan community and started to get teachings, I was very naive. I had never heard of any of this stuff, you know. And, you know, I grew up in northern Canada, for example, you know, where people killed things. That was normal. You know, if you grow up in northern Canada, you kill things, you know. You kill the things that annoy you, not necessarily people, but, you know, there's a lot of things to annoy you in northern Canada. You know, the mosquitoes, the black flies, you know, the various things that are out there just to get you all the time. You know, I have clear images of my mother running around the house with a fly swatter, you know, and folks going out hunting and fishing. And it never occurred to me that there might be another way of relating to the world. You know, and when I first heard, you know, well, actually, perhaps it might be useful to actually think about this. It was quite disconcerting to me, you know, to actually find that there might be a different way of living in the world. So listening to the teachings is actually what begins to set us on a path of questioning, gives us a sense of aspiration, gives us a sense of direction, almost. And the thing about listening to the teachings is that, you know, we find an echo inwardly often, a kind of remembering, quality of remembering. Then to explore the teachings, both intellectually and experientially. Intellectual agreement is deeply important, you know. We're educated, you know, we read, we have a lot of life experience, you know. And if I was to sit up here and propose to you indeed that the world is flat and you're just deluded, you know, you would probably say, no, this woman's, you know, really out of her mind, you know, and you would go no further. So it's very important that we have an intellectual agreement, but also an experiential agreement. Does this actually ring true in our own experience, you know? And does it actually have an outcome which is beneficial in applying what we hear? Do we find ourselves moving through life more lightly, more easefully? Do we find that there's a dropping away of some of the difficulties we've struggled with? Do we find ourselves more wakeful, more relational, more kind, more compassionate? So this experiential agreement is also deeply important because this is where we draw our confidence, our sense of possibility, our sense of capacity. And then, of course, the embodiment part is equally significant, isn't it? I mean, insights are meant to be practiced. You know, it's fine to hear about, you know, that aversion has a toxic effect and that kindness is a far bit more wholesome way to be in this world. But if we don't practice that insight, very little changes, doesn't it? I mean, we all know about change and instability. And then we consider the implications of that in our lives. And do we live in alignment with that understanding? And so the embodiment part, I think, is probably one of the greatest challenge, because we don't always have a cheering section around us, you know, that's in applauding our embodiment of insight. But all of these parts are significant. So the format of this weekend is a little bit different, because I do have a theme I'd like to explore, and I'd like to draw upon a few of the discourses which are quite unusual in the Majjhima, in the middle length sayings. And some of you will be familiar with these texts and some not, and it's fine if you're not. But just to know that in the collection of teachings of the Buddha, it's actually quite rare to find a continuum of theme that goes over several discourses. So the continuum of theme that I've chosen for this weekend around befriending the mind, befriending the heart, is that there is actually a small collection of discourses that really speaks to this. One of these I actually did cover last year when I was here in Untangling the Tangle, the Honeyball Sutta. But I'm actually going to draw on a few of the other discourses that sit alongside that. Now, just about the style and the format of the weekend, I don't want it just to be me speaking from the front. I hope that you will engage. I hope you will reflect and to think about how this applies to you, how you understand this. So I will do some teaching, and I'll have a lot of pause moments where you can actually speak to how this is landing with you, what's clear, what's unclear, whether it makes sense, whether it doesn't make sense. So be prepared to work a little bit this weekend. You know, be prepared to engage and not to think of yourself just as a sponge, you know, soaking up. You have voices, and we all have minds and questions. And, you know, one of the great skills, I think, in this path is developing our capacity to investigate and to inquire and to ask questions. As we said, the 2 days will be in silence while we're here, because it's almost as if it helps for us to provide the optimal conditions for learning and listening, you know. And I think calming down and having some stillness around us is one of those optimal conditions that inclines the mind towards being able to listen and being able to learn. Okay, so I think that's it about format. So what I want to do is, the theme I really want to look at is befriending the mind and heart, or cultivating a mind that feels to be a friend. I read a line from an actor, I think she was. She says, my mind feels like a bad neighborhood, a place where I'm reluctant to venture alone. Let's think about a mind that feels like a good neighborhood, that we actually feel at home in, that feels to be a friend. Also, as many of you know, mind, heart are terms that are used interchangeably in Buddhist psychology, so we don't talk about two separate phenomena. You know, we could talk about befriending the heart or befriending the mind or befriending the mind-heart. But these are not considered to be two distinct phenomena. So I want to look at some of the, a few of these early texts about how a mind, a heart of friendliness is really spoken of in these discourses. And I do want this not to be a theoretical contemplation, but one that we actually apply to our own experience. In one of the early teachings, the Buddha says, you know, who is my friend? He says, my mind is my friend. He goes on to say, who is my enemy? He says, my mind is my enemy. And the Buddha speaks of a mind of friendliness really in a number of different ways. A mind that abides in a climate of friendliness, of kindness, of compassion, of joy, of equanimity. Qualities that have been brought to fruition that become really the natural resting place of the mind. This is one way that this speaks of. He also speaks of the luminous, the radiant mind, the exalted mind, the clear mind, the collected mind, and the liberated mind. And I think this is one of the great aspirations of this path and this practice. It is the liberated mind. And what that is for us, how we understand that. What does a liberated mind look like? How would we know it? Do we get tastes of it? Do we get glimpses of it? What is this unshakable deliverance of the mind that the Buddha really places really as being at the center or actually the goal of the path? I think we do have glimpses of such a mind. I think we do have glimpses of a mind that feels to be a friend, but we have glimpses of calm. We have glimpses of spaciousness. We have glimpses of kindness. We have glimpses of clarity and sensitivity. I think these are not strangers to us. And, you know, one of the great genius, I think, of the Buddha was actually to build upon what we already know, or to build upon what we have already tasted. You know, the Buddha was not one for importing kind of esoteric metaphysical concepts. He actually says, you know, look at your own experience, the variation in your own experience, and actually to know those moments, those glimpses, when the mind feels a friend, accessible, a place you would wish to abide in. And actually, this is actually what we cultivate and what we develop. Meditation is hot on my list of words I'd like to put in the recycle bin. I realize we're not going to get rid of it. People think of themselves as meditating. But if you look to the early teachings, the word bhavana has been translated as meditation, but it's very, very presented very, very differently in the early teachings. Bhavana translates as to cultivate and to grow. And you have to remember, in the time of the Buddha, this was a very agriculturally based society and world. So when the Buddha would speak about growing things or cultivating things or bringing things into being, this would immediately land in a very felt sense way with the people he was speaking to. But this is actually what we are doing. We are cultivating or growing or bringing into being a mind that is a friend, those developing those qualities, you know, because too often I think in our lives, you know, as much as we taste the sweetness of calm or the sweetness of spaciousness or the sweetness of kindness, often those moments feel quite episodic and kind of unstable. And, you know, too often they although we treasure those moments, too often they disappear and we find ourselves in a mind that doesn't always feel like a friend. And it's good to recognize without any kind of judgment the mind that doesn't feel like a friend, you know. the mind that excels in obsession, in rumination, in proliferation, in confusion, in, you know, gripped by reactivity or habitual patterns or difficult moods, and of course the ongoing narrative. Or sometimes the mind that just simply doesn't stop. You know, it says the average person has 67,000 thoughts a day. And, you know, when we hear that, we think we're, you know, excelling, actually. We're above average. 67,000 would feel like a moderate, you know, moderate number, perhaps. But we actually, we know too well the mind that feels, you know, contracted or agitated or distracted, that doesn't feel free. It doesn't feel free. And this is what the mind that is a friend is its central quality, is that it has a sense of freedom. It has a sense of freedom. So the Buddha, you know, in looking at his own mind, in looking at the minds of those around him, you know, this is one of the central questions that he really placed in the path. You know, what does the liberated mind really look like? And what is it that really obstructs that our own potential for clarity, for stillness, for balance? Now, the early teachings, of course, speak a great deal about the deliverance of the mind. And I think it's good to sort of naturalize these phrases, you know, to actually realize when the Buddha was speaking about the deliverance of the mind, he wasn't actually speaking to a sort of spiritual elite. You know, he wasn't speaking to sort of, you know, sort of very special people, you know, who had this capacity. This is actually what he taught, you know. The deliverance of the mind that is no longer shaped by greed or by hatred or by delusion. The mind that can think creatively, clearly, lucidly. One of the synonyms of nibbana, a word I'm sure most of you are familiar with because it's not the rock group, by the way. One of the synonyms of nibbana, nibbana translates as not bound. Not bound. Ni is not, bana is bound. Okay? So nibbana translates as a mind that is not bound. And it's also, another of the synonyms of nibbana is nipapancha. Nipapancha. Now, some of you who are new may not be familiar with the word papancha. Many of you who are more experienced are familiar very much with both the word and the experience of papancha. But if you're not familiar with the word papancha, you're certainly familiar with the experience of papancha, which is this endless proliferation of thinking. Rooted in underlying tendencies and patterns that distorts our capacity to see things as they are. And the Buddha speaks about the cessation of this tendency of mind and remembering that papancha is always emotionally rooted or rooted in patterns. It's rooted in patterns of anxiety, it's rooted in patterns of view, it's rooted in patterns of aversion. It's rooted in the self-story patterns. This is what we proliferate about and think about. And it doesn't feel very free or spacious. So the practice that we do here, the practice of cultivation that we're engaging in, is much more than becoming calm or more mindful. I think it's really good to recognize that it's very nice to be calm and more mindful. Uh-huh. But this is never seen to be the sort of end of the path. In a way, calmness and mindfulness are almost embarkation points. They're the places where that really allow those optimal inner conditions for investigation, for inquiry, for insight. So calmness is a beginning where we can start to actually direct ourselves towards understanding this unshakable deliverance of mind, which I think really could be described as a mind which is a true friend. Some of you may be familiar with the writings of Nyanaponika Thera, one of the early teachers who actually really spoke about mindfulness and the path in a way that was accessible. And he speaks about these three steps of knowing the mind, shaping the mind, and liberating the mind. And of course, mindfulness is the step that allows us to actually know what is going on, that simple knowing. Shaping is where we begin to cultivate the conditions inwardly that incline the mind towards freedom and liberating the mind. So before we have a sit, I'd just like to come back to a quote from the Dhammapada. It says, all experience is led by mind, made by mind, shaped by mind. Speak or act with an unclear mind, and suffering follows as the wagon wheel follows the hoof of the ox. All experience is led by mind, made by mind, shaped by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never-departing shadow. It goes on to say, with our thoughts we make the world. All that we are arises with our thoughts. And this includes, of course, the world of self. Okay, so I thought we would take some time to have a sit, and then we'll have a bit of a stretch, and then we'll start to go into some of this material. Feel free to stand up for a moment if you feel you need a stretch. Okay, to continue with this, I want to speak a little bit more, and then we'll have a pause moment. I don't know how it was for you in that sitting or that walking period to actually bring the mindfulness much more to what's going on in your mind, but we've probably become aware that we have a sort of paradoxical relationship to our minds, that at times we're so infatuated with them, and at times we really are a bit hateful of them. We sit in meditation often, and we hear all the instructions about attending to the breath or attending to the body, which we indeed do visit intermittently, but mostly we're really interested in what's going on in here. You know, we're far more interested in our thoughts. This poor little breath down there, you know, hardly makes much of an impression, does it, before the sort of onslaught of our thinking and our narratives, our stories. We're often actually quite enchanted by our daydreams, our narratives, our plans, our memories, our strategizing, our rehearsing, the familiar pathways that the mind follows. And other times we just despair at how caught we can feel in our psychological, our emotional storms that distress us. Psychological habits that often really take us very far from where we wish to be, where we feel so burdened by our obsessions and our ruminations and our preoccupations that we're trying to use to solve distress. You know, how we're trying to use our ruminations and our obsessions and our thinking to actually problem solve, whereas actually they so are implicated in the distress that we're feeling. Much of the time, we actually really do, many people report, they do live from the neck up. You know, we are narrative-based beings. You know, Paul Brox, the neuropsychologist, describes human beings as storytelling machines, you know. And that she takes another perspective, that we are not telling the story, but the story is telling us who we are, and how the world is, and how other people are. There's a wonderful line that's used in Oxford University about professors having bodies just to carry their brains from meeting to meeting. And I think it might be really deeply important for us to examine, quite honestly, our own relationship to our mind. It seems to me that if we are really going to develop a mind that's a friend, first of all, one of the first steps is actually beginning to question and perhaps to become somewhat disenchanted with the infatuation we have with the contents of our minds. Is this where we wish to abide? Is this where we wish to make our home? I think perhaps we need to have some mature dissatisfaction with our preoccupations and with our papancha. And this mature dissatisfaction may also include our preoccupation with self, the me that is being constructed through our thoughts, and the sense of the self and the identified self that is the generator of so much of our thinking. If you really step back and have a sort of honest reflection upon what goes on in the mind in any day, a lot of it is really about me, just like the t-shirt says. You know, it actually really is all about me. Perhaps we need also, I think, to develop a love of stillness, rather than an infatuation with busyness. To develop a genuine love for stillness, collectedness, clarity, peace. And this may sound obvious, but I think it's actually not. And it is actually one of the reasons why the cultivation of inner collectedness is actually so highly stressed in meditative development. Because for many people, this sense of collectedness, this samatha, is really what offers the first taste of stillness and a deeply, inwardly generated happiness. You know, and when I think of samatha, which really, really describes the whole field of meditative development, it's often a more accurate translation would be this sense of collectedness, or the unification, the integration of body, mind, and present moment. And the image that I'm quite fond of using at the moment is the image of Welsh sheepdogs. Actually, you hear it a lot in the discourses. The simile that's often used is the cowherder. The cowherder. But I like the Welsh sheepdogs. I don't know if you've ever seen any Welsh sheepdogs in action or on television. But these are highly trained animals, you know. And they go out into the mountains and the fields of Wales. And they're really trained to gather the sheep, not intimidate them, not harm them, but to gather the sheep and take the sheep from pastures that no longer nourish them and move them into pastures that are nourishing. And this is what collectedness is really all about, samatha is all about. It's bringing our thoughts and our attention really from the fields that no longer really nourish or nurture us. And they are the fields of fantasy and reverie and rehearsal and strategizing and proliferation and rumination, and bringing our attention into the field of present moment recollectedness. I think for many people, the development of this quality of samatha is often offers the very first taste of some stillness and a sense of happiness and well-being that is generated from within rather than as being an outcome of having our various cravings satisfied. I think we also need to accept that the mind that it is a friend is really born of the willingness to undertake the training of the mind. And this is a training. I know some people have a bit of an allergy to the word, you know, they think of boot camp, you know, or, you know, this kind of like heavy-handed learning. But this is a training. We have such historical expertise in developing an untrained mind, don't we? You know, such historical expertise in developing our well-honed capacities for proliferation and rehearsing and strategizing. And this truly is a training of the mind. The Buddha was very clear on this. He says, I know of no one thing that can do so much harm or cause so much distress as an untrained mind. But once understood, I know of no one thing that can be a greater friend than a well-trained mind. And the Buddha stresses the need for a certain enthusiasm and a certain ardency and a passion in this. And he goes on in the Dhammapada to say, you know, it is a disciplined mind that knows true joy. It's a disciplined mind that knows true joy. There's another quote from the Dhammapada I'd like to share with you. It says, this restless, agitated mind, hard to protect, hard to control, the sage makes straight as a fletcher the shaft of an arrow. This mind, hard to control, flighty, alighting where it wishes, does well to train. The disciplined mind brings happiness. This mind, hard to see, subtle, alighting where it wishes, the sage protects. The protected mind brings happiness. The mind that obsesses becomes agitated, and the mind that is agitated is far from freedom. And the mind that doesn't obsess does not become agitated, and the mind that is not agitated is close to freedom. Goes on to say, whatever an enemy may do to an enemy, or haters one to another, far worse is the harm from one's own wrongly directed mind. Neither mother nor father nor anyone else dear to you can do one as much good as one's own well-directed mind. So this is something to cultivate. This is something to develop. This is something, this is a training in cultivation. And we can be very ambivalent about that. And, you know, perhaps many people tell me that they're more drawn to just sitting and seeing what happens, you know, or that's kind of a choiceless awareness that's portrayed as being effortless. This all sounds very attractive indeed. But training the mind actually really does involve effort and dedication and perseverance and commitment and patience. And remember this word, nibbana, not bound. Unbinding the mind from its habits, from those worn out pastures, does actually not come so easily. And yet perhaps there really isn't a deeper and finer aspiration to be found than the cultivation of a mind that is a friend. This is the end of suffering, as the Buddha puts it, the mind unbound. Now, this is not just about inner development. I've used the words optimal conditions already a couple of times today. A mind of friendliness really doesn't grow out of a vacuum. And in this path of awakening, of course, the Buddha taught much more than formal meditation. Really the cultivation of an awakened life that inclines the mind towards freedom rather than inclining the mind towards suffering. And so that awakened life is really a path that is cultivated that it means cultivating conditions inwardly and outwardly that incline the mind towards stillness, towards wakefulness, and towards peace. Many of these conditions, I think, are really familiar to pretty much everyone in this room. And they've been built into our lives, and I think we really feel the benefit of that. You know, ethics, integrity is a primary condition for inclining the mind towards wakefulness and towards peace and towards a freedom from residues, the freedom from regret and judgment and shame that follow in the footsteps of, you know, unethical thoughts or acts or speech. We know this. You know, we know that. We know what happens with this. I think we need to have often what the Buddha calls the seven treasures. This is one of those very neglected lists that incline the mind towards friendliness and freedom. Confidence is the first of those treasures. Confidence in our own possibilities of awakening. Confidence in our own capacity to develop the path and to develop a mind of friendliness. And it's this confidence actually that really sets the mind, sets us on a path, and actually confidence in our possibility of awakening and in the path is really what protects. It protects the mind from distractedness and from heedlessness. We know we're on a path, we know we begin, and we know where that path takes us. Ethics protects the mind and the world from greed and hatred and delusion. Self-respect is one of those treasures. That we live in a way that we feel is a life of dignity, a life free from self-judgment and self-blame, where our lives are aligned with a kind of ethical compass that really protects us from being governed by the impulses of wanting and not wanting, the impulses to have or to get rid of. Practicing generosity. It's one of those treasures. And generosity is another word for renunciation that really begins to loosen the bonds of fear and beliefs in insufficiency and that incline the mind towards understanding. So when we look at our mind, friendly or unfriendly, we might also want to examine the conditions inwardly and outwardly that foster a mind that doesn't feel to be a friend or that does feel to be a friend. And I think that's a question I would ask you. What are the conditions you can see in your own life that would foster a mind that doesn't feel to be a friend? Because we are not invulnerable to those conditions. That is actually a question, by the way. Anybody have any thoughts? What are the conditions outwardly that would really foster a mind that doesn't feel to be a friend? Yeah.
I think the people that you surround yourself with.
It's one of them. Yeah. I mean, the Buddha certainly didn't promote a sort of way of living where, you know, we only surround ourselves with people that agree with us and, you know, are aligned with us, knowing that that's more of a defensive life rather than a relational life. But he did say that those who associate only with the foolish have as much chance of tasting the Dharma as the ladle has of tasting the soup. Anybody else think of anything that fosters conditions that makes the mind really to be not a friend? Yes, please. Being shamed. Yeah. We hardly grow or thrive in an environment where we're, you know, consistently judged or blamed or shamed or not seen, not visible. Yeah.
Self-righteousness, needing to be righteous.
Yeah. Needing to win the argument all the time is hardly conducive to a mind of stillness. Yeah.
Out the sky.
seeking out distraction, this is a big one. It really is a big one. You know how when we're, it's kind of a closed feedback loop, isn't it? That when we're not easeful within ourselves, we tend to look outwardly for something that's going to make us feel better, feel good. And yet that looking outwardly, because it's only ever temporarily alleviating, kind of feeds back to deepen the sense of being not at ease or not content inwardly. And it's one of those closed feedback loops. And it's also really important what you say, that, I mean, we are obviously surrounded and live amidst a world, well, you know, countless stimulation every moment. But that point where we begin to seek out distractedness, that's a very crucial point to, I think, be able to pause within. Ah, what's actually going on in the mind here? I remember when we used to sit at Bastyr and you know, people would report going out in their walking meditation and kind of going through the motions of walking, but meanwhile, by the end of the walking period, they'd read every job advert and every housing possibility and you know, every course possibility, that they had no interest in pursuing any of these, but there was just something there about the hungriness of the mind and wanting that to be filled. Yeah.
Performance,
competition, but self-performance, needing to be somebody, needing to impress or needing to gain approval or affirmation. Yeah, this is a very big one that kind of constantly, and again, really seeing how much these are, again, closed feedback loops. You know, how we engage in those patterns and, you know, maybe have successes, maybe have failures, but how they constantly feed back to reinforce those patterns of discontent. Yeah.
Pleasure and craving.
Pleasure and craving, yep. Doesn't really work. It's actually remarkably ineffective in actually delivering a mind of friendliness. And it's also being aware of the agitation of craving. And it, just the simple agitation of it, how the mind is just not at ease in the grip of that kind of impulse. Yeah.
Well, like a kind of world, you lack of resources, lack of education, lack of basic resources, external circumstances, like teachers.
Isolation, yeah. Lack of community, lack of listening to teaching opportunities or learning opportunities. These are, I mean, as I said, we do not live in a bubble. We're not invulnerable to the world of conditions.
Water.
Yep.
I think sometimes we are afraid that people won't like us, respect us, approve of us if we're really authentic. So I think when we're afraid to be authentic, I think it really is disturbing.
What do you mean by authentic?
By admitting kind or whatever, but saying, living the life that you feel in your heart is the right one.
Yeah. Not afraid that that's going to sort of be disapproved of lose your status, lose your friends, or be greeted with some suspicion. So needing, again, it comes back into performance about fitting in. Fitting in, you know, fitting into the mold.
I think reactivity.
Yeah.
Read the newspaper. Just reacting. Just makes your mind into that.
Yeah, and it comes back to that metaphor, doesn't it, about throwing logs on the fire. And there's such a balance to be found in our lives, isn't there, to be the balance between being informed and actually knowing what is going on, and actually how much that we use that being informed as a sort of ground for actually working up self-righteousness, agitation, aversion, anxiety. I mean, I know in our household, in my home, you know, after the Brexit vote, we determined, everybody in my family determined, we will not speak of this for 3 days. And it was really a wise choice, you know. It was really a wise choice of you know, how you it wasn't that it wasn't in our mind, but actually about making choices about what we were going to individually or collectively fuel that would actually be unconducive to a mind of well-being. And it was, you know, it was just a small moratorium, you know, to draw breath. And actually, you know, to find a way of responding to difficult news that is actually not going to actually be adding more fuel to the fire.
This might be a variation or kind of a flip side, but pushing away, cutting yourself off, avoiding.
Yeah, there's a sort of two extremes, isn't there? There's either diving in and kind of fueling agitation, or as a sort of life-saving gesture, we think it's going to be to cut ourselves off, you know, and to say, you know, I'm going to try and find a position of not being touched, you know, and actually that too is you know, I mean, we actually know that aversion is fairly ineffective as a defense mechanism. And so to actually see that both of these, whether it's the moving, diving into, or fleeing from, both of them are cultivating a mind of instability, a mind that doesn't have equanimity, a mind that doesn't have ground. So it's such a fine balance in our lives to know how to relate to this world of conditions and not be governed by them, but to find the... You know, I remember one teacher I much admired, you know, was asked near the end of his life, what have you ever learnt from your whole life of practice? And he said, an appropriate response. An appropriate response.
Unethical conduct. So, being doing harm.
Yep. I mean, it is true. You know, the Buddha did place ethical training as being the base ground for training a mind of friendliness, because, you know, without that, I mean, I think it was Upandita who once said, you know, how do you expect your practice to deepen and your mind to develop without ethics, because all you're doing is creating the conditions for unpleasant states of mind to appear, which is, I think, evident in our own experience. Yeah.
Maybe that's the same as what I was thinking in terms of lack of self-care, in terms of not getting enough sleep, not eating well, seeing, you know, tending to medical conditions.
Yeah. An exhausted mind is truly vulnerable to difficult mind states. And sometimes I think there's a certain humility and honesty in recognizing that, you know, those kind of resources do get exhausted inwardly. And if we don't take care of those resources, we don't have the energy to take care of the mind. It takes a lot of energy, actually, to train this mind and incline this mind towards friendliness. Yeah.
About the mind state of overwhelm or hopelessness.
The mind state of overwhelm or hopelessness, I mean, this is where we've retreated to a sense of impossibility, isn't it? And impossibility says something about how we actually view ourselves and view our capacity. It is kind of like why one of those seven treasures, you know, really is confidence confidence in capacity, confidence in the path. And confidence is not so easily won, you know, because, I mean, for some people, this is not just a story they tell themselves, it's a story they've been told by others, you know, that things are impossible or, you know, you're not able. So confidence is not something that is easily won, but I think confidence is actually supported by many of these other conditions we've been speaking about, you know, about the commitment to ethics, the commitment to caring for oneself and resources, the commitment to actually developing the mind. You know, I mean, I find in teaching, you know, I mean, you know, even in very short retreats, I'm actually often awed by the amount of change a person's mind can go through in just actually a few days of training, you know? And I think people surprise themselves, you know, they think, well, oh, it's because I've got all these conducive conditions and, you know, this wonderful spot I'm practicing on. But none of that would have made any difference without their own sincerity and their own intention. And that's actually where confidence begins. You know, by actually tasting that and appreciating that those transformations are really inwardly generated. Okay, so let's go on a little bit. Thank you for that. So in exploring this pathway of developing a mind that's a friend, I think we first begin by contemplating what our understanding is of what this mind is, because we use it, you know, always as, you know, this noun, this thing, this, well, you know, we're not quite sure what it is, but we know it's my mind. And there's a certain relief, I think, in beginning to know the mind is a process. The mind is a verb. We are in a process of minding. It's not that we have a mind or a mind has us. We are in a process of minding rather than a thing. And as I mentioned before, we went out for the walking period in the Satipatthana when the Buddha speaks about knowing the mind that's affected by hate and not affected by hate, affected by delusion and not affected by delusion, contracted mind and spacious mind. And when we look at this in our own experience, this is, we actually see how the mind is so constantly changing, affected by moods, affected by the body, affected by sensory impression, affected by feeling, happy mind, sad mind, agitated mind, calmed mind. And the good news is that because the mind is a process and a verb, it actually can be changed, developed, and cultivated. So there is nothing that is a life sentence about the mind that you have right now. This is not predetermined. It is not static. It is not a thing. And the mind doesn't have an independent self-existence, but is being born and shaped moment to moment by a world of conditions. And we have choices within this process. And we come to know that what we feed will grow. If we feed the habits of distractedness, obsession, proliferation, we will get better at them and they will grow. So whatever we practice, we get better at. If we feed the capacity for collectedness, for calmness, for clarity, for kindness, these too will grow. And this is very much a life practice, isn't it? It's not just a cushion practice. It's about what we do at our lunch break, what we do when we walk the halls, and about whether we choose in that moment, you know, to feed that distractedness, or whether we choose actually to feed the collectedness. And it goes back to that very core teaching of the Buddha, that what we frequently think about and dwell upon, to this does the mind incline. What we frequently think about and dwell upon, to this does the mind incline. So if we frequently think about and dwell in agitation, this actually will become the inclination of the mind. If we think about and cultivate and dwell in stillness, and non-distractedness and kindness, this too will become the inclination of the mind. And what we frequently think about and dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind and indeed the shape of our world. I think we know this, don't we? The anxious mind lives in a very, very different world than the mind of confidence and stillness. The aversive mind lives in a very, very different world than the mind that is shaped by compassion and by balance. This is how we live in these very personal worlds. So I want to go to a few, start with one of these discourses that are somewhat unusual in the Pali Canon, because they do have this continuum of cultivating a mind of friendliness or training the mind. Before I do that, are there any questions, any reflections anyone wants to raise? Yes, please.
I have a question. One thing I've noticed as I become aware, I feel like I've become more aware over the years of practice of the kind of whiplash of, as you talked about, the mind going here and going there, and now it's happy, now it's sad, and seeing how much the conditions are dictating that, and then I feel exhausted. And I don't know, I was wondering if you could speak to that. Like, I'm frustrated. I just want to stop whiplashing, you know? So, like, some sort of equanimity with non-equanimity, or I don't know.
So the question is around feeling the exhaustion that comes with mindfulness. Of just seeing how the mind is bouncing between these extremes of being for and against and up and down and, you know, so vulnerable to conditions. And I mean, you're exhausted by it without the mindfulness, by the way. So it's not that the mindfulness makes you exhausted. It's pretty exhausting without the mindfulness. And, you know, I think it's probably, it's growing pains. It's the first step of waking up, is actually to feel the painfulness of living in that way. You know, we do a lot to disguise the painfulness of that, the painfulness of this mind that just feels to have a life of its own and, you know, it often feels quite out of control and without choice. I mean, to actually wake up and experience the painfulness of that is actually really important. I don't think there's a shortcut around that. But then it's what you do next that is what is really important. You sort of dissolve into the painfulness and the exhaustion and actually say, okay, this is my classroom. You know, and you can't think of the big picture, you know, of how many moments in a day your mind has done that. You have to think of the present moment picture of where is my mind right now. You know, how do I find the collectedness? How do I find the stillness right now? You know, in the midst of that oscillating and in the midst of those movements, what is still? What is calm? Where can you actually rest and collect yourself? Okay. So I'm going to pick up this mighty tome. And I do encourage you, it was too much to think of getting printouts for all of these for everyone. But I do encourage you to actually, most of this is available online, and you don't have to memorize it, and I will read it. So I want to start with a discourse that's called Two Kinds of Thought. And I'll read this. It's a very short discourse, and I may not read it all, but it usually begins, most discourses are conversations. They're conversations between the Buddha and people that he meets on his travels and on his way. And on this, in this discourse, the Buddha's addressing a group of people who've gathered. He says, before my awakening, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two categories. Then I set on one side the thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of kindness, and thoughts of compassion. And I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute. A thought of sensual desire arose of me, and I understand this. This thought has arisen. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nirvana. When I considered all of this, the thoughts subsided. When I thought this leads to others' affliction, it subsided. When I thought this thought leads to the affliction of both, it subsided. And when I considered this thought obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nirvana, it subsided. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. And he goes on to say, whatever a person frequently thinks and ponders upon, this will become the inclination of the mind. If we frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, we have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual desire. And then the mind inclines towards the thought of sensual desire. If we frequently think about and ponder upon thoughts of ill will, upon thoughts of cruelty, we have abandoned the thoughts of kindness and compassion to cultivate the thoughts of ill will and cruelty. Now, leads away from freedom. I'll go back. Two kinds of thoughts. So, first of all, we understand it's actually looking at the thoughts that arise. And actually, thoughts and intentions are used a little bit interchangeably here. Okay? So, it's actually putting these thoughts into two categories. They lead to one's own affliction, the affliction of others, the affliction of both, they obstruct wisdom, and they lead away from freedom. Okay? So this is the quality of discernment. Now, this is not about judgment, and I think it's very important in our own minds that we know the difference between discernment and judgment. Because I think culturally, you know, we have actually got such an allergy to judgment and the effects of judgment that we tend to think that we need to abandon it all. And sometimes we throw discernment out with judgment. Discernment is absolutely, absolutely, totally critical in the path of awakening as the Buddha taught it. Discernment is not about right and wrong. It's about good and bad. It's actually about what I just read. Is this helpful? Is this unhelpful? Does this lead from freedom? Does this lead away from freedom? Does this cause affliction to myself and others? Does it bring about the end of affliction to myself and others? Does this obstruct wisdom? Or does this foster wisdom? So the Buddha's actually sitting down, looking at his mind, looking at his thoughts, and actually looking at which camp his thoughts are in. It's that kind of simple. It's very important that to see that discernment is actually the bridge between mindfulness and appropriate response. You know, without discernment, mindfulness is deeply in danger of becoming a sort of passive observation, actually, which may have some effectiveness, but very, very limited effectiveness in terms of actually undertaking a path of training, which is dynamic, conscious, intentional. And it also would render mindfulness ineffective in terms of contributing to the end of affliction in the world around us. You know, if you were to go outside and see somebody sort of beating up on a dog, you know, that dog would actually really not benefit from your mindfulness. The mindfulness would actually need to make that bridge between knowing what leads to affliction and how to bring the affliction to an end through appropriate response. Now, this quality of discernment actually rescues mindfulness from passivity. Being clear about how many of our thoughts, intentions, and actions have their roots in sensual craving, in ill will, and in harshness. Because being very aware that, and you've probably noticed this in your own experience, that many of these kind of moods or mind states of ill will or harshness or craving, they tend to be major generators of papancha, of proliferation, of obsession, of preoccupation. When you look at the kind of thoughts you experience in your own day, in your own mind, you know, you tend not to do a lot of proliferating around calmness or around compassion or around spaciousness. You know, you don't get up and say, oh, gee, I wonder why I'm spacious. You know, I don't know why I'm spacious. I don't know where that came from, you know. Oh, it's not fair that I'm spacious. Most of our proliferation really revolves around the unwholesome. And I invite you to check that out in your own experience. So sensual craving, ill will, harshness set in motion obsession, compulsion. They contract the mind, beset the mind, and imprison the mind. On the other side, there are the intentions and the thoughts of metta, compassion, and renunciation. So this is very much a stepped contemplation, isn't it? It's having sufficient mindfulness to know when a thought of sensual desire has arisen, when a thought of ill will or harshness has arisen, to having sufficient mindfulness to actually know this, and then to be able to have that, follow that on with a very honest reflection. What is the outcome of this? Where is this going to take us? Where is this going to take us in our own minds? Where is it going to take us in relationship to others? Do we see any outcome of craving, ill will, and harshness that is not affliction? We might imagine there might be, but do we actually see any outcome that is not affliction of ourselves and others? So it's not, you know, in this examination of these two kinds of thoughts, it's not just about our personal world and how our obsessions and proliferations impact upon ourselves, but how they impact upon the others, upon the world around us. And many people would say, well, what is the problem really with sensual desire? You know, what is the problem really with sensual craving? You know, what is really the problem with forgetfulness? What is the problem with being busy with getting what I want? What is the problem? I would ask you. What is the problem of sensual desire, of sensual craving? After all, it's a very primary dedication of our culture. Yeah.
It leads to suffering.
How does it lead to suffering?
When watched, it feels like it's evident that suffering is associated with a behavior.
With that, that suffering is associated with the behavior of sensual craving. Yeah.
It's very, very short term, and the result is not helpful. It continues itself.
Yeah.
When you want something, you tell yourself that you'll be happy.
When you want something, you tell yourself you're only going to be happy if you get it. So, you know, here unfolds the whole world of delusion, doesn't it? That somehow happiness and unhappiness are implicit in the object or the thing or the experience or the event that we get. That it's like looking at the world and saying, make me happy. You know, and I don't know if you've ever been in a relationship when somebody looks you in the eye and says, make me happy. That would feel like quite a pressure, wouldn't it? You know, we would probably actually say, I actually don't actually have the power to make you happy. But with sensual craving, there's a conviction and that way of looking at the world and saying, make me happy, which actually, as you point out, really does reinforce also that ideology of inner deficit and insufficiency and a culture of lack. And that is such a pursuit and an obsession in our culture, isn't it? To have more, to gain more, in the pursuit of this elusive satisfaction, which is only ever really temporarily provided. Any other problems with sensual desire? Actually, there's not enough in this world for people's greed, as Gandhi stated it. That there is enough in this world for people's need, but there's not enough in this world for people's greed. And we become aware how complicit we can become in actually the feeling of not having enough. So there's an ethical dimension to the abandoning of sensual craving. Even though on one level it feels quite benign, there's actually quite an ethical and I think a compassionate dimension to our willingness to release the grip of that impulse and the grip of that sort of propelling power that feels so familiar to us. And it's the way, I think, with sensual craving, when we're in the grip of it, it's not that it doesn't arise, and I really want to make that distinction between the arising of sensual craving, which usually arises out of mind states of discontent. You know, when there's actually a great deal of, or even some level of contentment and well-being inwardly, these are not the moments we get hungry in our eyes or in our ears or in our bodies, in our minds, to have something. But to actually be able to come back, to actually, where is that arising from? You know, it's not that it never arises, but to use that as a point of investigation and a point of inquiry rather than a point of launching into how do I get this or how do I make this happen. But it's also really seeing the imprisonment of it. You know, the mind that is bound by sensual craving is obsessed, isn't it? You know, it's often said, you know, the mind of hate and the mind of craving share a strong bond. They are both obsessed with the object of their hatred or the object of their craving. And there's that sense of imprisonment without it and prioritizing what I need and what I want. So how does this obstruct wisdom? I did warn you I was going to make you work on today. How does the grip of sensual craving obstruct wisdom? What does it do to obstruct wisdom?
The focus on the outward instead of the inward.
The focus on the outwardly generated rather than the inwardly generated. It kind of forgets about impermanence a little bit. Quite a lot of amnesia about impermanence in there. There's quite a lot of amnesia around self and non-self. You can really see with sensual craving how the kind of self-reification gets stronger and stronger, you know, and dependent upon that fulfillment and getting. It's to some extent it's a denial of dukkha. Sensual craving is what we're doing perhaps to distract ourselves from an awareness of dukkha, of change, of pain. You know, how often we use sensual craving actually to get away from sadness or to get away from discontent or, you know, to somehow camouflage all that. Leads away from freedom, a mind unbound. Mindfulness leads, as it was said in the sutta, I was aware of this thought or this intention and it subsided. Well, that's a short version, isn't it? Have you ever found yourself being mindful of it and it not subsiding? Quite possibly, isn't it? Isn't it curious that we can have, you know, a quality of awareness of what is going on and it still has that sort of you know, propulsion, almost that fuel within it, that it continues even as we're mindful of it. And it's one of those disturbing aspects of mindfulness, isn't it? That we feel to be ourselves, you know, a spectator upon our own disasters. You know, as many people would say, I was much more happy before I began practicing, you know. Now I'm aware of what I'm doing and I'm doing it anyway. That's really frustrating, isn't it? It is so frustrating. And so that's the kind of short version. I'm mindful of it and it passes away. Well, that's not actually the case in everybody's experience. So the Buddha goes on, the thought of sensual desire arose in me and I abandoned it and I removed it. I abandoned it and I removed it. Now, what does that... Or a thought of ill will arose in me. Or a thought of cruelty or harshness arose in me. And I abandoned it and I removed it. How does that land with you? How would you do that?
It seems to me that he didn't remove it, but the wisdom from right view saw that and it was removed.
Possibly. I'm going to repeat this because I know some of you can't hear what people are saying in the front, especially. That it wasn't so much that he removed it or abandoned it, but actually that the conditions were in place for the removal and the abandoning of the thoughts of ill will and cruelty and harshness, such as wise view, understanding, actually not allowing it to take a grip. But it does sound a little bit more forceful than that. When a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. When a thought of ill will arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. It's almost presenting as being also a little bit kind of effortful. Well, yeah, and how renunciation happens. How renunciation happens, because I don't think there's just one layer of renunciation. I mean, I'm pretty sure that most everybody in this room has had the experience of shouting at themselves to let go of something with quite spectacular lack of success. Even worse when other people shout at you to let go of something and you meet the same lack of success. So it's very clear that renunciation is not an act of will, you know. It's not an autonomous action, you know. It's not as if I've got some wise little me just sort of hiding in the shadow somewhere inside my psyche, you know, and in some difficult moment this of clinging and holding, this wise little me is going to jump to the forefront and let go, you know. It's not how it works, is it? I mean, I hope we agree on that. But renunciation, abandoning, I mean, this word abandonment, I'm sure to many Western ears sounds really quite forceful, you know, and quite resolute, you know, and it doesn't quite fit in always with our ideas of, you know, being gently mindful, and then actually I'm going to abandon something. Mm-hmm. I think it's you know, this fabric of renunciation, I think, is has many layers, you know. I mean, first of all, one of the layers is, of course, it's not an autonomous act of renunciation because I don't do the letting go. But if we look again to the teachings, the whole focus upon, you know, if you look at the path, the whole focus upon the cultivation of the liberating, the cultivation of the wholesome inwardly, the cultivation of the healing qualities inwardly, of kindness, of compassion, of clarity, that actually this is actually what does the effect of letting go, the cultivation of that wise view. That's one dimension of investigation renunciation. And I think that is a very important reorientation for many people in practice, particularly in the West, where we tend to transfer our work ethic, our finely developed work ethic, from our lives right into our practice. And, you know, how many people are working on something just now? You know, we're working on our greed, or, you know, we're working on our jealousy, or we're working on our anxiety, or we're, you know, we're working on our resentments, or, you know, people suffer from an overdose of earnestness and overwork, is my experience in Western practice. Or if we get exhausted from that, we recede into the opposite extreme, where I shall float along on a cloud of choiceless awareness, which looks remarkably close to choiceless spaciness. You know, and what is the middle path in there? You know, how much do we reorient ourselves rather than thinking of this long and endless list of imperfections that I have to work on? How much do we reorient ourselves to thinking, what is being cultivated right now? What is being, when you sit down in a meditation period, a walking or a sitting, do you ever sit down with the question of, What is being cultivated right now? What amongst those qualities of spaciousness, of calm, am I consciously cultivating? What we frequently think about and dwell upon, to this does the mind incline. We often don't see in our earnestness of working upon things the way that our attention is already flavored by that which we are working on. And our sense of self is already defined by that which we are working on. I think for many people it's a radical shift in orientation to think, I'm going to just sit down and cultivate stillness. I'm going to walk and cultivate calm. And to walk and, or sit and cultivate collectedness or kindness or compassion. And I really invite you to check this out in your own experience. You know, if you've ever, you know, sat or walked with a very uncollected, very, very unsettled mind, you know, and a difficult thought or a difficult memory or a difficult emotion arises, and it just sticks because there are the perfect optimal conditions for sticking. You know? And you can sit or walk in another moment where the mind feels far more collected, far more steady, far more spacious. And exactly the same thought or memory or difficult emotion will come along, but it will just pass on through because the conditions are not ripe for stickiness. You know, and if you think a lot about what we're doing in meditative training, we're cultivating that inner climate of non-stickiness through what is being cultivated. But abandonment is something else. You know, this also involves a quality of resoluteness. I think it involves an understanding that we're no longer willing to volunteer for suffering. You know, and it's not always easy because sometimes the habit is so ingrained, isn't it, of taking hold of and dwelling in those thoughts of craving or a will or cruelty. You know, the habits are so strong that actually we need a certain resoluteness to actually say, you know, I'm just not going to volunteer for suffering in this moment. You know, and in one of the discourses that I will actually go into later on, I'll actually talk about the ways that the Buddha actually talks about embodying that resoluteness of understanding, that we know this leads to affliction. We know it leads inwardly and outwardly to affliction. I'm simply actually not going to consent to engaging in that which furthers that sense of affliction. And that's quite, you know, that is very resolute. That it's not just a gentle hoping this is just going to fade away. It is actually an intention and a determination. How does that land with you?
Is that sort of the purpose of the gatekeeper and the windows and the doors and at the door? It's like, it's not being saying, this is, you know, I'm not feeling this, but, you know, I'm not allowing this to enter.
I'm not going to entertain it. You know, it's kind of the difference between someone knocking on your door and knocking at the gates of the city uninvited and offering them a glass of water and a recognition and an acknowledgement, but not a 5-course meal. It's the willingness to not entertain it. And we know that the tendency to entertain it can be so, so strong and finely developed. Hmm? Yeah.
Yeah, I had an example of this morning where I woke up, and from the time I woke up, there was this sort of obsessive thought about something needed to get done. I really wanted to do that. I would enjoy doing that. And I kept getting pulled back to that.
Yeah.
And I came here, and I'm sitting, and I keep, you know, this thought is constantly, I'm watching this thought arise. And at some point, though, I'm sitting here listening, and I'm having even trouble listening to what you're saying, because the thought is constantly interrupting. And at some point, I remembered, oh, listening to the Dharma is a wholesome activity. And so I just went, I'm just going to listen to the Dharma, and the thought subsided.
Yeah.
So it's just kind of, it works.
Yeah, it works. It works. It's just feeling the sort of the temptation of the obsession knocking on the door of consciousness, you know, and noticing that if you open the door even a little bit, you're lost. You know, there's no just thing as a little obsession. you know, there is simply the pattern of obsessing. You know, and it's really having that resoluteness and that determination not to foster the pattern of obsession, which often means that we take our attention elsewhere, which is what you did. You decide to take your attention to somewhere, a pasture that's more fertile, even though there's still that background knocking on the door, and it may last all day, you know, it may last 2 days, it might last 3 days, you know, it might last a week, but there's only that one moment where you actually say, no, I'm just not going to open the door to this. I'm just going to abandon it. Take your attention elsewhere. Anybody else got any well-developed skills for abandoning? Yeah.
I don't. I have a question.
Okay.
When you say entertain, is that a synonym for feeding energy?
Yeah. Entertain has been a synonym for feeding energy into it, whether it's kind of, you know, why is this, whether it's speculation, you know, why is this here, what does this say about me, whether it's entertainment, you know, I'm sort of delighting in this particular obsession or this particular reverie, you know, whatever way we're feeding energy into the obsession. Remembering obsessions do not have independent self-existence, they rely upon that feeding. Yeah.
So then, the wording that is in the discourse you were reading, it sounds partially like not feeding, but it also sounds partially like actively crushing or abandoning.
Which I will get into in one of the other discourses that's around this subject. There is an act of resoluteness here. There's an act of determination here. You know, and often when the Buddha speaks about, you know, changing the shape of the mind and beginning to wake up, he so speaks about swimming against the tide, you know, because you can see the sort of energy and the power just through repetition of many of those impulses and psychological habits, you know, and it feels like, you know, just watching is really not enough. It's really not enough. That's it.
Well, what you were saying reminded me, I've been reading the Book of Joy, that's the Dalai Lama, and the Dalai Lama talked about cultivating compassion, generosity, you know, all of this stuff, as a kind of immunity. I can't remember the exact term. He says, yes, you will be developing this immunity so that when you do end up being confronted by things that you want to renounce, you develop, I mean, it was kind of the way you develop this immunity over time.
Yeah. Yeah. This is.
So during this month of my greetings with Bill Guy, I've been so aware of the pain that's inside, that when some people have responded to me in some pretty, what has been received as a thoughtless, kind of taking it very hurtfully, and the tendency was to start blaming and getting all obsessed with why they say that and why they're doing that. But being so aware of the pain, I went to, I don't want to add any more pain.
Yeah.
And compassion, I guess, is the word, because what came up is everybody's doing the best they can.
Yeah.
And for, actually, it's like a gift of the grief, is to be so aware of how much pain there is that I'm not going to choose anymore.
Yeah.
And there has been a kind of resoluteness of just enough. I'm not going to add any more to it. And so out of that came that the compassion,
yeah,
the understanding, or the truth that really everybody is doing the best they can.
Yeah. But it's really to see that important part, because we're not entertaining the intentions of compassion and the intentions of proliferation or aversion at the same time. And this is where we're making our choices. And it is really that protective domain, I think, of mindfulness, which is so often underestimated. You know, and the gatekeeper is one metaphor for that, or simile for that protective element of mindfulness. It's actually knowing, you know, in times of greatest vulnerability, the gatekeeper really needs to be on duty. Really needs to be on duty. You know, and the gatekeeper in that sense is, you know, it's not defensive, it's not pushing away, but it's actually knowing what is possible in that moment, you know. And also knowing that we just don't need to take on trying to explain somebody else's mind. We're having enough on our plate, actually. We're really just trying to take care of our own in that moment. Yeah. So before we break for lunch, I just want to give a little bit of a praise of what we've covered this morning. And since, you know, the heart of the Buddha's teaching and quest was really to bring about the end of struggle and suffering and alienation and disconnection, and was very clear that to bring about an end of all of this, we need to understand how it arises, not only in the very big pictures, but in the details of our lives and in the movements of our own mind. You know, how is struggle coming into being, and how is it coming to an end? And so in the discourse we've been touching upon this morning, in a way, the Buddha's getting quite simple here, because he's really placing his finger upon three primary impulses or patterns that have many, many offspring and offshoots. The patterns of craving, you know, and the effect of that, the outcome of that upon our lives, upon our minds, upon our worlds. The impulse of ill will, which we know has a very big extended family, doesn't it? You know, jealousy, impatience, frustration, comparing, evaluating, disliking. They're very big. And this impulse of harshness. He uses it, it's often translated as cruelty, but it's much more this sense of harshness, of inflicting harm. And the Buddha was very clear that these are much the root of the obsessions, the ruminations, the proliferations we have. This is the stuff we think about. This is the stuff we dwell on. This is the stuff that ravages the well-being of our minds and hearts. So he's speaking about making this transition from these embedded impulses. He uses this, the discourse is called the two kinds of thought, but thought here really is used interchangeably with intention, okay? He's getting very simple about the kind of intentions that actually form the thinking processes, shape the mind and shape the world. Then he speaks about making this shift, you know, from that which really causes struggle and suffering to that which actually leads to freedom of heart, to the deliverance of the mind, to the end of affliction. And here he uses these very three simple trainings: renunciation, which we'll go into even more. Sometimes another word for renunciation is generosity. It's not holding. It's not contracting around. So it can be, you know, the very committed, resolute acts of abandoning that which has arisen, which is unhelpful, which leads to affliction. And it can also be framed differently in cultivating the generosity of heart, which actually doesn't contract and doesn't cling. And he puts these three qualities together of renunciation, of kindness, and of compassion. And he describes these intentions as being, you know, what can form our thinking processes, shape our mind states, shape our world, shape our way of being present in the world in the midst of all things. In the midst of all things. So this is the kind of shift that's really being encouraged here, to come out of that which causes affliction and into that deliverance of heart, which is a way of caring not only for our own freedom, but actually for the freedom and well-being of all beings and of the world that we live in. So that's basically the essence of what we're talking about. I hope that's clear. Basically the precis of what we're talking about here and what we'll continue with after lunch. So just before we continue, is there anything lingering from this morning that... Yes, please.
I was wondering about the notion of discernment.
Mm-hmm.
You talked about it leading to appropriate action, and in your story about Brexit.
Yes.
And then 3 days of not talking about it, wondering what happened after that. And in thinking about appropriate action in a time like this, when there's so much injustice, that you can get caught up in all the news and whatever, which, you know, gets into its own obsession. But just removing yourself from that doesn't really speak to the appropriateness of what should happen now.
So the question is around discernment and the example I gave post-Brexit of having the decision not to speak about it in our household for 3 days, you know, and what actually moves you to appropriate response. And again, that line we walk between the need for us to acknowledge our interconnectedness and our connectedness and to be informed, rather than seeking to retreat into some sort of defended bubble, you know, and being aware not only in the wider level, but also, and this is what the teaching is really speaking to, that really on the microcosmic level, we are always interfacing with the world around us, you know, with our thoughts and with our words and with our acts and the choices that we have to engage in the wholesome or the unwholesome. And the appropriate response, well, there isn't one appropriate response, is there? There are many appropriate responses. But I don't know how it is for you in your experience, but in my experience, the appropriate response rarely arises from agitation, anxiety, and ill will. It's just so clear to me that if I am to make an appropriate response, both to the very moment I'm interfacing with and the wider world that we live in, that we are participant in and part of, with all its cruelty and injustice and hatred, for that appropriate response to be made, I think this discourse is really speaking to it. You know, what is it that is guiding our thoughts, words, and acts? This actually really does matter, because it's those thoughts, words, and acts that leave their own footprint on the world around us, either contributing to greater agitation and ill will and fear, or lessening that and contributing in small, in ways that we don't even see, contributing to the healing of ill will and anxiety and fear. And the thing is that we can't act in a way where we're trying to foresee always the consequences, because we don't know our every word and our every act, and many of our thoughts splinter into consequences that we will never actually see or don't see. So what this discourse is actually speaking to is actually where we are making the home of our mind. And discernment is really, really significant here. You know, and to really know it's not about judgment, but we actually really need to discern inwardly what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, what is helpful and what is unhelpful, what leads towards freedom, and not just our own personal freedom, what leads towards freedom and what leads away from freedom, what leads to affliction and what leads to the end of affliction. And it's not like we have a cause-effect moment where we actually see that, but we actually do know, the only thing we actually can know, actually, is the ground of our of these intentions, these understandings, because these intentions are actually understandings. They're not just, I intend to act this way. This is actually rooted in what I spoke about just before lunch, about what causes suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. So discernment is critical here, you know, and I do think sometimes in the way that we inherit meditative teachings in the West, you know, we foreground watching and observing above investigation and inquiry. You know, and I think it's really important to be aware both of the benefits of watching and observing. It's one of the first steps of mindfulness, you know, is to be able to turn the mind and the body into an object of mindfulness and to be able to see it, you know. And this is part of the process of decentering, disidentifying, beginning to have a relationship with the afflictive and with the lovely. But there's always a certain distancing in that watching and observing. And it's used for very good reasons, but it's a stepping back in order to step back into, but with new eyes, the eyes of renunciation, the eyes of kindness, the eyes of compassion. I don't know if that answers your question. There is not one appropriate response. There are many. Hmm? Yes.
Well, I had a question. My questions were about discernment too. I maybe said a lot of what you said about it, but I think it's tricky. It can be really tricky, and I was thinking about a couple of stumbling blocks that can cloud your discernment, and one is kind of a short-term aspect that would be a short-term payoff, or you could do something that may seem like it was helping someone, but in the further down the road, it turns out
it's not.
I'm thinking of something like a white lie or something, you know, maybe it spared somebody's feelings for the moment, but further down the road, you find out that that wasn't true and that it's worse. And then I was thinking about, but the thing I think is tricky for me is and Sousa's comment kind of triggered this thought, I guess, of, you know, tricky separating out when self is the guiding force.
Yes.
That, you know, you can think you're doing something to comfort somebody or help someone, but you know, sometimes, you know, in that situation, I think some people just don't know how they're not used to that situation or what to do. But I've had the experience where, you know, it can work. I've done it, and other people have done it, where it can turn into something that's all about me, you know. I'm going to be there, I'm going to help you, I'll be by your side, and I I don't mean you, and you can think that you're being generous and being comforting and that sort of thing. And it's really hard sometimes to see what is the
yes. Yes. Discernment is not easy. Discernment is complex in that there's many things that can disguise themselves as discernment, you know, self-protection. And, of course, we always think that we see things clearly, don't we? You know, that's basically one of our delusions. Of course I'm seeing things the way that they actually are. No, I'm seeing things through certain eyes, you know. So discernment is always going to be tricky territory that involves a lot of investigation and honesty, you know. And sometimes we don't know, you know. I think if we waited to act until we were 100% sure, you know, that we were seeing things totally clearly, we may actually just sit on a cushion for the rest of our lives, you know, and really not engage at all. So I think we have to take that risk. I think we have to take that risk and be willing to learn from that risk. I think what's being pointed to here is really being so sensitized to the presence of craving, ill will, and harshness. And really being sensitized to the presence of renunciation and kindness and compassion. And that takes a considerable amount of inner sensitivity and awareness. Because, you know, it's not like ill will always has a big voice. You know, sometimes it's a very quiet whisper. You know, sometimes craving doesn't always have a big voice. Sometimes it has a very quiet whisper, you know. So it's actually learning to develop that sensitivity, and we make mistakes with it, you know. We make mistakes with it. Okay, one.
Just what is kindness and what is compassion?
No, it's a good question. I mean, And I could actually spend the rest of the afternoon talking about that. But I don't do brief very well, but I'll do my best to do brief. In the Buddhist teaching, the word of kindness is metta, which is not loving kindness. Okay, love is a different word in Pali. Metta comes from, its roots are in the word to be a friend to. To be a friend to. So it is an attitude, it's actually a verb of befriending. Caring for the well-being of ourselves and others and being willing to stand near to with an attitude of care all things. Compassion in Buddhist psychology is very complex. Compassion is a word we have borrowed to translate anukampa karuna, which is the Pali term for compassion. And anukampa is, if we summarized it, it's empathy. It's often the translation is the heart that can tremble in the face of suffering. The heart that can tremble in the face of suffering. The karuna part is often an outgoing kindness, but it is what we do on the grounds of that empathy. It has its roots in the word to act. To act in the service of uprooting suffering and its origins. So it's good to have that in mind, because we're not talking about particular emotional states or feeling states here. We're talking about behavioral gestures of the mind. You don't actually have to feel kind to act with kindness. You don't have to feel compassion to act compassionately. So we are talking about inclining of the mind towards these capacities which are seen as virtues. They're seen as seeds of potentiality. They're seen as being fruitions of the path. And they're seen as cultivations. Okay, that's the condensed version. Okay. Okay, so to go on a little bit, I think this paragraph here is quite stark, and I think it's deeply significant. I'm losing my papers. If one frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of sensual craving, they have abandoned the thought of renunciation to cultivate the thought of sensual craving. And then the mind inclines towards sensual craving. If one frequently thinks about and ponders upon thoughts of ill will, they have abandoned the thoughts of kindness in order to think those thoughts of ill will. If we frequently think about and ponder upon thoughts of harshness, we have abandoned compassion in order to think those thoughts of harshness. This I think, is an incredibly crucial point. It is about the choices we unconsciously and consciously make about where we make the home of our mind. And it is to see that in order to entertain or to ponder upon and think about thoughts of aversion and ill will, we have actually abandoned the intention of metta and kindness. Every time we sort of walk down that path of entertaining and pondering upon thoughts of craving, we have actually abandoned thoughts of renunciation, of generosity. When we move towards thinking about or pondering upon thoughts of harshness, we have actually abandoned compassion in order to do this. This is very crucial in the path, I think. And this is actually what has so many consequences for ourselves, to a sense of actually a huge dissonance in our lives, where our actions and our thoughts and our behaviors can feel so separated from and so dissociated from not only our deepest values, but actually also dissociated from what we actually know leads to suffering and what leads to the end of suffering. So there's a huge sacrifice being made, actually, a very telling sacrifice being made in order to engage in those thoughts and intentions of craving and aversion and harshness. We actually have abandoned that which we most deeply value, aspire to. In a sense, we abandon a path of freedom, because this is what leads away from freedom. And it's not even as if we consciously choose to do this, do we? It's not like we get up in the morning and think, you know, great day for craving, you know, or, yeah, you know, it's a great day for, you know, a good bout of ill will or harshness. It's not as if we consciously do this, but it really speaks to the blinding power of some of these psychological, emotional habits. However, sometimes we might consciously do it. I mean, sometimes we see we're just caught by those surges. There are other times when there can be a certain strange, perverse pleasure in some of this, particularly in, you know, think about the time we might spend fantasizing about some better moment or some future delight, you know, or lost in those reveries, and you know, find for sure a certain pleasure or satisfaction within them. And there's a certain self-building within them too, isn't there? There's a certain way I kind of reify a sense of self through that. I mean, even though ill will, you know, if we look at it very closely, is actually quite painful. I'm sure nobody here does this at all. But there can be a certain pleasure in ill will. you know, condemning others or, you know, or judging, you know, collectively with others, judging someone or, you know, there can be a certain pleasure in entertaining those thoughts about, you know, really, you know, how terrible someone is or, you know, it there's so many ways that manifests, isn't it? Gossip is a classic example of this. Having renounced what leads to our well-being in order to cultivate that which undermines our well-being. This is an odd one, isn't it? It's an uncomfortable one. In the Dhammapada, as I mentioned, I think, last night, it's not difficult for us to cultivate that which is harmful to us. Far more difficult to cultivate that which contributes to our well-being. And so, you know, part of this movement towards that which causes affliction, that which imprisons us, that which leads away from freedom, part of this is simply the unconscious power of habit, and part of it is self-building, and part of it we can actually be somewhat attached to, strangely. That's a kind of an uncomfortable truth, I think. But what is important to see is that they are not coexisting in the same moment. In order to cultivate that which afflicts, we have to renounce that which leads to the end of affliction. I don't know how that lands with you. It makes me squirm a little. Sometimes there's a positive discomfort or a wholesome discomfort. And in speaking to this in the discourse, the Buddha goes on, just as in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn when the crops thicken, a cowherder would guard their cows by constantly tapping them and poking them on this side and that with a stick to check and curb them. Why is that? Because they see that they could see the danger, the degradation, and the defilement in unwholesome states, and they can see in wholesome states the blessings of renunciation. So here, the Buddha is actually speaking about renunciation. Sometimes has a forerunner, and the forerunner is restraint. I always think as restraint as being actually, you know, because as we spoke about this morning, you can't suddenly decide to let go of something. But sometimes restraining the impulses of craving or of ill will or of harshness is indeed within the realm of possibility. Before those impulses reach our speech, before they reach our actions, probably not before they reach our thoughts, but even then, in the realm of thoughts, the restraint of not feeding that which has arisen is one of the primary forerunners of being able to release that which leads to affliction and leads away from freedom. Restraint's not a popular, again, this is not a popular pursuit, I think, culturally. You know, in fact, all our messages tell us the opposite, you know. That non-restraint is a measure of our freedom and our success, whereas actually non-restraint is the measure sometimes of our habits and the power of our habits. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of renunciation arose in me. I understood this. This thought of renunciation has arisen. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom. It does not cause difficulties and leads to nirvana. If I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and a day, I see nothing to fear in it. I see nothing to fear in it. This is important, that we actually see that there is nothing to fear in generosity and release and relinquishing and unbinding, that there's nothing to fear in kindness and compassion. Whereas actually, what the Buddha said in the preceding paragraph, there is that to actually fear in craving, in ill will, and in harshness. Does that make sense to you? But then he goes on. He says, but with excessive thinking and pondering, upon renunciation, kindness, and compassion, but with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body, and when the body is tired, the mind becomes strained. And when the mind is strained, it is far from collectedness. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to single-pointedness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be strained. Here is even there's a kind of warning about holding to and obsessing even about the wholesome. Even about the wholesome. And actually pointing out that the very nature of obsession is its exhausting nature. And when the mind is exhausted, it is uncollected. And it is vulnerable to mental states. So here the Buddha is actually pointing not just to the objects that are obsessed about, but to the very pattern of obsessing, whether it is to the wholesome or to the unwholesome. Similarly, not exhausting the mind, not losing that sense of inner collectedness. But he's very much tying renunciation in here with happiness. That there is nothing to fear from renunciation. It's not an annihilation of self. Pointing this direct relationship between release, releasing, relinquishing, and happiness. And a sense of safety. A sense of safety, that there is nothing to fear in this. And it goes on. Oh, pause moment. Anything up for anyone? Yeah.
This is bringing up a lot for me, and I'm very appreciative of that. One of the things that I think we can touch on, which is seminal, just briefly, I was the only witness of assassination in a foreign country. And noticing for a variety of, for quite a while, the repetitive memories that were surfacing of the assassination and something else that happened, that involved getting killed. That I noticed after a period of time that, because you mentioned perversity, so why not? But there was a negative, almost a, I wouldn't use the word perverse, but almost a high, an adrenaline high that was felt positively, even though it was a negative experience, it was almost addictive, in the obsession, in remembering what happened. And when I realized that, I tried to stop it. I couldn't do what you're saying, just cut it off. But what I could do is when it started, I realized that I didn't have to go there.
Yeah.
That was an incredible release.
Yeah.
And then I applied that to some other things in my past that I also realized I no longer had to go there. I had a choice with the obsessional thinking. And then just a couple of days ago, I noticed also I was doing a little obsessing as normal. And I realized that there was a negative thing, that it was an energy. Even though it was a negative thing, there was an energetic, I don't know if I used the word addictive, but there was, you know, there was this negative perverse pleasure or something.
There is an addiction in obsession. There is an addiction in obsession. It's an addictive quality. We keep it, you know, it's like you know, you've got a little chip in your tooth and your tongue just keeps returning there. you know. There's an addiction to it. There's a sense of so many things held within it. Bear in mind, in Buddhist psychology, obsession has a slightly different implication than we think of it. It's kind of thinking the same thought more than once. You're already into obsession. But it's that mixture of feelings in it, both the unpleasantness and the pleasantness of maybe the aliveness of it, or the excitement of it, or the excitement of it. And this is why obsession is so attractive. It's also attractive because we think it's problem solving, you know. And if we just go around that loop one more time, you know, we're going to get that secret magical insight, you know, pop out, and the problem's going to be solved. You know, I think of it as obsession as the gum chewing exercise. You know, you first start chewing a piece of gum and it's kind of tasty and savory. And then imagine if you just had to keep chewing that same piece of gum, you know, for the next 24 hours. You know, it's dried out, the taste is gone, but the jaws are just going away, you know, mechanically in that rut. You know, it's the gum chewing exercise. And, you know, sometimes it should occur to us just to take the gum out. You know, it's like it's done. There is no more insight going to be squeezed out of going around that loop one more time. The well is dry. We have learned everything there is to learn. There is no more to learn. And now we are just actually afflicting ourselves. And this is why we go into the next discourse I'm going to cover, because it's not so easy to get out of those loops. So I want to finish up this piece. The Buddha says, in seeing that which leads towards freedom and that which leads away from freedom, see what leads to affliction, what leads to the end of affliction. Tireless energy was aroused in me and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. Quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, etc., etc. And at the end of it, he says, birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more coming into any state of being. So that was that. We often get the short version, don't we? It sounds really simple, you know. You go down, you sit beneath the tree, you know, in the roots of a tree, you know, you cross your legs, close your eyes, you enter into first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth jhana, you know, insight dawns, and you get up, and what needs to be done has been done. You know, there's no more to be done. We often get the abbreviated version. It sounds pretty quick, doesn't it? It's kind of like, oh, well, that's all there is to it. I think it seems to all happen all very quickly, but it's helpful to know that other discourses acknowledge the challenges we encounter in that journey to getting to where that place where what needs to be done has been done. Okay, so if you want to study this or look at this discourse more, it's number 19 in the Middle Length Sayings, and it's called Two Kinds of Thought. So anyway, it is some food for thought to begin with. So before I move on, just want to ask if there's anything lingering, anything unsettled. Yeah.
I was curious to hear about the difference between energetic renunciation and aversion.
Yeah.
You might have answered it already in obsession.
I think that's what we're coming to in this next discourse. Okay? Because it is a very fine line between this energetic abandoning, removing, getting rid of, you know, the words that are used in the discourses, uprooting, and where that's an act of aversion and where it's an actual act of releasing out of kindness and compassion for one's own well-being. Okay? Not because we don't like it. This is probably the basic difference. Not because we don't like it. Yeah.
Just a quick question about harshness. Mm-hmm. The third. I'm so used to thinking about craving and then aversion, and harshness is often, at least in my understanding, part of aversion, or can be part of aversion. Is it meant to be closer to delusion and ignorance? Not necessarily harshness.
I think harshness has been the opposite of compassion. It's a surrender of empathy. We don't have at that moment present available for us the empathy for our hearts to tremble in the face of suffering. So we've also, of course, lost the second part of compassion, which is the wish to relieve suffering. In my sense, harshness is actually doing harm, or the wish almost for another to suffer. Now, this, you know, this can be, you know, quite camouflaged, but, you know, where we sort of celebrate somebody's misfortunes, where we dismiss people. You know, think about what harshness looks like when we no longer have any empathy for someone, and we sort of dismiss them from the possibilities of any understanding or any respect or any possibility of their changing. It's a kind of condemnation. I think there's harshness in many of the isms that sort of shadow our culture. I think there's a great deal of harshness of, you know, well, you know, you deserve it, you brought it upon yourself. I think there's a lot of mana or conceit of self in harshness, that I'm somehow superior to you, so I don't actually have that much empathy with what's going on for you. But I think it's more this sense of abandoning someone or dismissing someone. And of course we do this to ourselves also. This is not just an external movement. Harsh speech, I mean, we see this spoken about a lot in the discourses. Condemning speech, you know, shaming speech, speech that actually hurts. Because if we think that part of compassion is this outgoing kindness, I think harshness is also this outgoing condemnation and dismissal. Yes, please.
It makes me think of the times that it makes me feel really regretful and sad. The times that even when I need to be acting well, but for lack of attention, I caused harm. Therefore, I dismiss, not deliberately being dismissive, but because I haven't seen.
Yeah.
I haven't paid close attention.
Yeah.
How, I guess we could put that under harshness then, too. Just
inattention and not understanding, not having empathy. But inattention is certainly the forerunner of most acts of aversion or ill will or harshness or neglect, for sure. So this discourse we've just been looking at today so far really is about transforming the shape of our minds. You know, if you think about even kindness and compassion featuring so strongly in this discourse, and we refer that kindness and compassion to the teachings on the Brahma Viharas, you know, Vihara means your home, where you live, where you abide. And it's the encouragement really to abide, to establish a home within these qualities that lead to an end of affliction, but recognizing that we don't actually have kindness and compassion, I think, without renunciation. Because it's really the renunciation of the ill will, it's the renunciation of the harshness, it's the renunciation of the craving that actually allows the flowering of kindness and compassion. and generosity, but it's also the cultivation of generosity, kindness, and compassion that allows for the releasing of ill will and harshness and craving. This is a kind of simultaneous development and release. It's not always that one precedes the other. And as far as I can understand, in the early teachings, this is a simultaneous operation, but far more the orientation on the cultivation of the lovely and the liberating, rather than me working on the unlovely. Okay, we're ready to proceed. So the second discourse, and remembering this sort of basic context of this weekend, which is about really cultivating a mind which is a friend, you know, and to think of what that mind would look like for you. So the second discourse, the title of it is somewhat misleading because it's titled The Removal of Distracting Thoughts, which actually sounds a little bit benign, doesn't it? You know, the removal of distracting thoughts. Well, that's kind of not too difficult. What the Buddha means by distracting thoughts are actually the most intractable, stubborn, non-negotiable, impervious to mindfulness patterns that beset us, okay? The ones that are repetitive, the ones that go so far back we can't even trace their beginning, we may even have inherited them, you know, and at this point it might be useful just to take a few minutes and to think of your most intractable patterns. The short list, you know, not the long list, the short list. Where does your mind go most frequently that troubles you? Is it in jealousy? Is it in resentment? Is it in insecurity? Is it to anxiety? Is it to judgment, aversion? You know, where does your mind go most frequently that troubles you and afflicts you? That feels kind of, you know, you're about ready to throw up your hands and surrender, you know, and thinking all things change, but not this. You know, I've discovered the one thing that is exempt from impermanence, you know, my tendency towards impatience or my tendency towards jealousy or frustration or comparing or insecurity. This is the distracting thoughts. This is the distracting thoughts. You've done everything you can with them. You know, you've been mindful of them. You know, you've thrown boundless amounts of metta at them, and still they arise. And the refrain that's repeated most often in this particular discourse is, "And if it still arises." And if it still arises. The Buddha, I think, was a realist. You know, he knew the compulsive, habitual nature of psychological patterns and how challenging it really is to wake up and how challenging it is to cultivate a mind of friendliness. And he was so aware of how easily we get hooked by the mind we would rather be free from. And many of our psychological habits that lead to distress are historical. They're not only psychological patterns, they're well-worn neural pathways. In fact, at this point, they're ditches, more of that nature than just pathways. Again, sounds fairly light. They're learned behaviors. They're often learned behaviors. They're learned from others. They're learned from our life experience. They've often been coping mechanisms, some of them. You know, they've been strategically adopted as defense patterns, as ways of defending the self from harm, not seeing actually how much these patterns do more harm than almost anything in the world can do to us. And we often despair in the face of them, feeling the impossibility of ever truly changing the shape of our mind. In Pali, these are called sankharas. They are called sankharas. They are habitual, psychological, emotional patterns of reactivity that are rooted in confusion and misunderstanding. Okay? These are the ones that beset us. And sometimes these patterns are actually quite unconscious. We're in them before we even know that we're operating through them. They've become almost our MO, you know. This is how we live in the world. We don't even consider that there's another way of living in the world. And in this discourse, the Buddha offers a range of ways to approach the most intractable, stubborn patterns of mind that beset us. Now, this really points to the kind of effort that is much more conscious and much more resolute. You know? This actually points to a way of approaching our mind that truly is a training. And the Buddha speaks, I read you. I'll read you this, and the language of this discourse actually is quite awkward to hear in the beginning, so hopefully I'll unpack it for you a little bit. Because when a practitioner is pursuing the higher mind, from time to time, they should give attention to five signs. What are the five? When a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, and owing to that sign, there arise in him unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then they should give attention to some other sign connected with that which is wholesome. When they give attention to some other sign connected with that which is wholesome, then any unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, hate, and delusion are abandoned and subside. With the abandoning of them, their mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. Just as a skillful carpenter or their apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one, so too, when a bhikkhu gives attention to some other sign connected with the wholesome, the mind becomes steadied. So, complicated. Higher mind. What does that actually mean? It's a very strange translation. If you look at some of the other texts, he's actually talking about the cultivation of the liberated mind and the mind that is really free from greed, hatred, and delusion, and the mind that is imbued with understanding, kindness, and non-clinging. Now, it's important that, you know, greed, hatred, and delusion sounds like kind of like big words, you know, and we probably don't often think of ourselves as being really greedy, I hope. Or we often might not think of ourselves as being really hate-filled. You know, it's a very potent word. You know, aversion, we're kind of familiar with, but hate feels really powerful and strong. You know, we actually might consider ourselves fairly deluded. But otherwise, we wouldn't keep falling over our feet all the time and wondering how we ended up where we ended up. But it's important to understand the continuums here. Okay, so first, where does greed, hatred, and delusion come from? In traditional Buddhist psychology, these are the three manifestations of avidya, or ignorance. Okay, so ignorance is not pointing here to an absence of knowledge, but to a distorted way of seeing. So when we think about what avidya is, we have to think of the vipassanas, which are the distortions. Now, don't take this personally, because this is just simply the universal nature of ignorance. This is what ignorance looks like. Ignorance, again, sounds like a sort of, what does that even mean? It actually means distortion. So there are a number of different distortions. We see permanence where things are impermanent. Okay? And that means, you know, this is going to last forever, whatever I'm feeling right now. Or you are always like this. Or I am always like this. When we see solidity, reification, self, in objects, in events, experiences, when we see that kind of solidity, this is really solid, this is really permanent. So that's the first of the distortions, is to see permanence where there is no permanence. This creates a lot of panic in the mind, doesn't it? It creates a lot of agitation in the mind. I'm always going to be like this, and you're always going to be like that, you know? This creates a lot of... Wow, that's a hard one, isn't it? Always. Always. You know, you're always heedless, you know, or you always do this. To see the satisfactory in the unsatisfactory. This is a distortion of the mind. Think of some examples of that. You know, I might think it actually kind of satisfactory to be lost in daydreams much of my life, you know, or planning or rehearsing. I might see that as kind of satisfactory. You know, I might see it as satisfactory to actually settle for very limited horizons in my own sense of possibility. You know, a little calm might be nice, but liberation not, you know. That's another domain of more subtle, finding satisfactory where it's unsatisfactory. It might, we might find living in distractedness and busyness and agitation satisfactory. In fact, in parts of our culture, that's called success. You know, that I don't have any time free, you know, my calendar is full, you know. I don't have any time to attend to anything, but my calendar is full. You know, we might see that as being satisfactory. Think of some examples of seeing the satisfactory and the unsatisfactory. What can you find?
Accumulating wealth and things.
Seeing accumulating wealth and possessions and becomings and identities. Yeah. Winning an argument, that's very satisfying, isn't it? Yes. Even no matter the cost. Think of where we see satisfactoriness in the unsatisfactory.
Checking off the to-do list.
Checking off the to-do list, yeah. Watching the evening news. Depends how many times you watch it. The second plate of food, even though I'm already full. It's a good thing to reflect on. Seeing the satisfactory as unsatisfactory as being satisfactory is a distortion of mind. Seeing the unbeautiful to be beautiful. There's some very coarse examples of this, you know, such as porn or eating disorders. You know, there's some very extreme examples of this. Seeing the unbeautiful to be beautiful. Imagine if you wore your insides on the outside. How would you feel about the body? Seeing the unbeautiful to be beautiful. Seeing a permanent, abiding, self-existing self where there is none. This is a distortion of the mind. Not only as an internal fabrication, but in all things. Seeing an independent self-existence when there is only a changing nature of selfing. Okay? So these are the kind of distortions that make up this territory of what we call ignorance or avidya. Now, avidya we don't see until it erupts. You know, it's a little bit like a latent volcano, you know. So we don't actually see ignorance until it erupts. And the first way that ignorance erupts is through greed, hatred, and delusion. For example, there is no ground for greed apart from seeing an independent self-existence in something or someone that holds the implicit power to make me happy. There is no ground for ill will apart from seeing an implicit power in something, someone, to disturb me or make me unhappy. That doesn't mean that there's no difficulties in the world, by the way, or no unpleasantness in the world. There's plenty of that. So aversion and greed operate on the ground of distortion. Seeing satisfactoriness where there's unsatisfactoriness, seeing self-existence where there is no self-existence, provides the ground for greed and for ill will to arise, and also delusion, the confusion that comes when, you know, we sit there bewildered about why our strategies aren't quite working out the way we thought they would. You know, we got what we wanted, and actually there's still discontent. Well, how does that figure, you know? Oh, we've managed to be punitive, and there's still ill will. You know, we've managed to get rid of the unpleasant people in our lives, and there's still ill will. So that kind of delusion and confusion about what is actually going on here. Now, those three patterns, sankharas, have five more eruptions. Ones that you are far more familiar with, which are the hindrances. So see the continuum from the avidya to the greed, hatred, delusion, to the hindrances, which are far more obvious to us, the craving for sensual pleasure, again, the aversion, the restlessness and worry, the sloth and torpor and numbness, and the doubt. So these are actually the sankharas that get associated with the mind that is not liberated. So it's good to get a sense of the landscape of the unliberated mind without taking it too personally, because, you know, if anyone got up here and spoke about their, you know, portfolio of sankharas, rather than looking out at, you know, a group of people with shocked expressions on their faces, you know, you'd probably be looking out at people going, So it's quite useful not to take this all too personally. So the signs, it's really speaking about our relationship with the world of the sense doors and sensory impression, including the mind. That is what the sign is. So this discourse actually really, I think, really speaks to the art of meditative development and how we employ skillful effort. Because it's not just watching and observing. That's always our starting point, to actually know what's going on. You know, to have sufficient mindfulness in place to actually know what is going on. But it's not, the wise effort is much more about just watching and observing and kind of having our fingers crossed that the afflictions will just disappear in the face of that watching or observing. We begin to see how our patterns or sankharas are stimulated. And then the Buddha says, take your attention elsewhere. Take your attention elsewhere. Now that's interesting, isn't it? You know, because we so often hear a sort of unspoken command system within mindfulness and within meditative practice of stay with it, stay with it, stay with it. And if you don't stay with it, you're avoiding it and you're copping out and, you know, you're kind of a failure in your practice. Here there's the explicit instruction, you know, when your mind is caught by unwholesome sankharas, take your attention elsewhere to that which is wholesome. Take your attention elsewhere to that which is unwholesome. Because so often we see when any of these patterns arise, we either get into despair mode or we get busy. You know, I'm going to work on this. How do I fix this? You know, how do I go into this? I have to stay with this. See how quickly this is actually one of our prime sankharas, is actually to get into this doing mode of fixing or finding a solution or hammering at the doors until the right insight appears. But how we actually tend to narrow down and contract around and focus in the unwholesome pattern that has arisen. Does anybody do this? Does anybody do this? So this is what I was speaking about earlier, about bringing this reorientation to the practice. In the face of the unwholesome, cultivate the wholesome. What might that be? It might be metta, it might be compassion, it might be empathy. Personally, I find that compassion is often a far more effective response to ill will, even than metta. Do we actually take our attention to something that is outside of the field of the unwholesome, to the sense doors that are still listening, touching, seeing? How do we step out of that territory? Some of you, we need to not approach this path as a project of improving ourselves. This is so important. I think some of you are probably familiar with that story in the discourses where the Buddha comes across this fellow in a forest, and he's standing on one leg, and he's been standing there forever. And the Buddha says, what are you doing? You know? And the man answers, he says, I'm working out my karma. And the Buddha says, oh. He says, how much have you got rid of? You know? And the man says, well, actually, I don't know. And the Buddha says, well, how much have you got left to work out? And the man says, well, actually, I don't know. And the Buddha says, well, how will you know when you're done? And the man says, well, actually, I don't know. And it's one of those moments when the Buddha, you know, steps into one of his tirades about foolish practice and, you know, misguidedness. But actually, you know, we have our own ways of being that person standing on one leg on the forest, you know, the projects that we have, you know, how many times we come into a retreat and it's the right time to work on my anger, you know, or this retreat I'm working on my jealousy, or this time I'm working on this or working on that. And it's not to say that we ignore all of this, but it's actually to really see how much sankharas, unwholesome sankharas, are actually attached to a belief in self, and how the belief in self and the sankharas are interacting mechanisms. You know, and as long as there is an identification with an independent self here, me, who I am, no matter how much we work out, the very nature of being identified with a fixed self is actually to create and pick up new sankharas. I would suggest that the work is endless. I would suggest that the work is endless as long as it is rooted in that basic distortion of mind which sees an independent self-existence that I call me. That I call me. So he goes on. He says, so you've actually noticed it. You've actually noticed what's going on. You've taken your attention to something which is more wholesome. And then he says, and if when giving attention to that which is connected with the wholesome, it still arises, these patterns of greed, these patterns of hatred, these patterns of delusion, then we should examine actually the danger in these. We should reflect on where do they take us? What is their outcome? What do they do to the quality of our mind to actually entertain these thoughts or these patterns? How do they undermine us? How do they undermine our sense of possibility and confidence and aspiration? How much do they actually simply, as it said, these thoughts are unwholesome, they result in suffering. That's simple. And we learn again to abandon them. Do you want to really read? Oh, yeah, I'll read it anyway. Sometimes the discourses are a little graphic, you know. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornaments, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around their neck, so too, when a bhikkhu examines the danger in these thoughts, the mind becomes steadied. The mind becomes steadied and internally quieted, brought to singleness and concentrated. If it still arises, and be aware we're talking about this whole spectrum of sankharas. Again, the instruction is take your attention elsewhere. Take your attention elsewhere. I think sometimes we don't always appreciate that when we're giving attention to the difficult, how much the very nature of our attention is already flavored by the difficult. You know? Oh, I'm so judgmental. Oh, I don't want to be judgmental. You know? Oh, I have to let go of being judgmental. Oh, I have to become this non-judgmental person. Our attention is already flavored by the difficult. And here we're actually dealing with a mind which is contracted around the difficult. Personally, I have found there's a great skillfulness in consciously cultivating an awareness of coexistence. I mean, coexistence is a simple fact, isn't it? I mean, the sound of the train coexists with the quietude. You know, once the lights in the room coexist with the mats. You know, the places that are painful in our bodies are actually coexisting with the places that are well. Personally, I think there's a great skillfulness in bringing this far more into the forefront of our attention, particularly in those times when we see the mind is becoming quite contracted, and it becomes contracted through identification. This is the nature of identification, is to shrink around whatever is being identified with. You know? So when there is identification with that which is unwholesome, with jealousy, with rage, with anxiety, you can see in the mind contracting, the sense of coexistence really disappears. We enter into a kind of amnesia about coexistence. And I think coexistence is something to quite consciously reclaim in the midst of identification and in the midst of that contractedness. And it's not in any way trying to diminish, you know, the difficult, but it is to see that contractedness and identification is really a process of seizing upon a fragment of experience and mistaking that fragment to be the whole. Someone annoys us, you know, and how much we kind of focus in and contract around what it is they do that annoys us, you know. Maybe your partner always leaves the newspapers on the floor, you know, or the teaspoons on the countertop, you know, or your teenager, you know, never picks up their towels from the bathroom, you know, or whatever it is, you know, we contract around that which irritates us, or actually that which we really crave. But in that contracting around, we're seizing upon a fragment of experience and mistaking it to be the whole. You are. They have the sense, you are. We do this, of course, to ourselves also. You know? We see a pattern of judgment arise, and we identify with it, and we contract around it. And I'm such a judgmental person. We have entirely forgotten the 100 moments of generosity we've engaged in that day. You know? There's a pain in the body, and we see how the attention is drawn to it. You know, and I am so ill, or I am in so much pain. Actually, my palm of my hand is perfectly at ease. So we learn to take our attention elsewhere and into this domain of coexistence, and for that coexistence to be more than just a fact, for it to be a peaceful coexistence, means that actually we're releasing those patterns of ill will or craving and identification. We're allowing that coexistence to be equally present in our awareness. Goes on. If it still arises, we give attention to stilling the thought formation of those thoughts. We give attention to stilling the ill will, to stilling the craving. This sounds very counterintuitive, doesn't it? Because we actually really see that the very nature of ill will, the nature of craving, holds so much agitation within it, doesn't it? It's kind of hyper-vigilant, it's hyper-alert, it's excited, it's agitated. And it seems so counterintuitive to go to stillness. And yet this is what is truly recommended. How do I still this? I actually really develop my capacity for stilling the mind through one-pointedness. This is a very undeveloped capacity in many people. It is the Achilles heel of many people's practice, that of not knowing how to still inwardly the agitations of the patterns. And this, quite frankly, really opens up, I think, the challenge and the invitation of this path we're on. And this is really one of the characteristics of a mind that is a friend, is it knows how to have access to that stillness in the midst of that which is agitated. In the midst of that which is agitated. You know, it is why, I mean, we all know that developing a really well-developed, reliable one-pointedness, that this is not a practice many people are drawn to very easily, because it really does take such discipline and perseverance and dedication. But personally, in my experience, my understanding, that one of our greatest friends and allies in this world of agitation, inwardly and outwardly, is our capacity to be able to find that stillness inwardly. And that without it, the mind is so vulnerable to sankharas. So vulnerable to these patterns. So I would really encourage you to consider, how much you make this part of your practice, not only on retreats, but actually as a life practice. How much do we sort of tend to move towards the uncollected mind, the distracted mind, the overloaded mind, the overburdened mind, much more than we actually focus on cultivating stillness. And this really is an off-the-cushion practice too. Again, using that example, of being at Bastia and I'm doing my walking practice and I'm reading every notice on the board. That's a kind of a choice. It may be an unconscious choice. It's certainly driven by patterns. Or how much in the midst of that do I say, actually, this is really a time to unify and to integrate body, mind, and present moment, and being able to sustain attention. And this is not easy, is it? It's one thing, to apply attention, and to run into a breath every now and again, and then to forget, and then to remember and forget and remember. But this capacity to sustain attentiveness, to be able to hold the mind steady, is so central to the development of stillness. And stillness, by the way, does not mean, it doesn't mean that the world has died, It means the absence of reactivity. It means the cessation of that movement towards and away from. So it's being able to hold the world of sensory impressions, being able to hold the pleasant and the unpleasant, but not being caught in those movements of moving towards, moving away from. This is a cultivation for our lives, not for our cushions, yes, but also for our lives. Does that make sense to you? Please.
I'm curious about between the three and the third and the fourth. I understand conceptually how they're different, but in practice it seems like both might be returning to an anchor or kind of settling into...
Take your attention to somewhere that is wholesome.
The take attention elsewhere, and then the one you're just talking about now is still the practice in that moment. How
take your attention elsewhere means really a conscious movement away from the object that you're being drawn to through greed or craving or ill will to something that is wholesome. Now, the anchor of your attention is not by itself wholesome. You know, your breath is not by very implicit nature wholesome. It's just your breath.
The first one was turning to something
wholesome. Yeah, turning to something wholesome like metta, like compassion.
Okay, so then the third one was take your attention elsewhere.
Take your attention elsewhere, and that's where you are becoming much more to an anchor.
Okay. And then the fourth
You might not go to your anchor. You might or you might not. It might more be about what you're doing with your sense doors. It might actually really be highlighting stillness as your anchor. Highlighting stillness as your anchor. Sometimes taking your attention to what is wholesome is actually a reflection on impermanence. It's a reflection on non-self. Pause a moment. Yeah.
Can you do a guided meditation on that stillness one? I mean, to me that seems really challenging. And is it like one technique, or it depends on your intention to be still? And however you...
I don't think it's one technique. I mean, even when you read the Satipatthana, you know, the first instruction is to breathe in, calming the formations, to breathe out, calming the formations. And the formations are the sankharas, you know. It's anything that is agitated. But sometimes it's even just simply highlighting stillness as a quality of presence that is accessible. You know, right now, if you go to, you know, here is all this movement in your body, in your mind. Where is there stillness just now? What is not caught in any movement towards or away from anything? And sometimes we get the clues of that in the body. And sometimes we get the clues of it just in a sense of inhabiting the moment without craving or aversion. Just with receptivity, the equality of attentiveness, the non-preferencing of attentiveness. I mean, this is such an art to develop, you know, but part of it is, as I've mentioned, this capacity to be able to collect, to gather, to unify. And this is where the samatha element comes in so strongly. If it's still... Sorry, please.
Yeah, I had a question. I can use a little clarification about sankharas. I guess I've been hearing you use them as afflicted or wholesome. Aren't they also possibly wholesome?
Okay. No, good question. I mean, sankhara actually means formation. It means anything that is formed. You know, so in a sense, this lectern is a sankhara. You know, so on that level, it means anything that is formed, that is brought together by conditions. When it's used in Buddhist psychology, it is used in terms of patterns. Now, many of those patterns, and here's the discernment, which of those patterns are afflictive and which are non-afflictive. In reality, many in cultivating the path, we are cultivating wholesome sankharas. We are cultivating wholesome sankharas. Mindfulness is a sankhara. Metta is a sankhara. So we're cultivating wholesome sankharas to meet that which is, you know, in the midst of the unwholesome sankharas that are really rooted in greed, hatred, and delusion. So yes, you're absolutely right. So the last of these, and I'm kind of moving through this, if it still arises... Oh, by the way, it's often said that this collected mind, this capacity for collectedness, is what blindfolds Mara, blindfolds the hindrances, you know, blindfolds the capacity of greed, hatred, and delusion to really take root. I think it actually does much more than just temporarily blindfolding Mara. I think this is a way in which Mara can find no root, and it's much more than just meditative development. It is actually how the mind is actually cultivated to be collected, unified, and integrated. But the Buddha was a realist, you know, and he says, if it still arises, these patterns still arises. Okay, let me find the absolute best translation. If the unwholesome thoughts connected with craving, hate, and delusion still arise, okay, this is quite direct, then with teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of their mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. We don't hear that instruction on retreat very often. It's interesting how we're very selective in what we take from the discourses. That suit our cultural proclivities. Tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth. And, you know, well, first of all, try it. Certainly draws your attention in, doesn't it? This is what abandoning is about. This is what abandoning is about. And this is what I referred to earlier when, you know, we have investigated over and over. And it's very important that we've done enough investigation in our lives that we have a pretty clear comprehension, you know, psychological and emotional literacy to know how we have ended up being the kind of person we believe ourselves to be just now. You know? It's very important that we have that clear comprehension. Because, you know, as human beings, we are born of so many conditions, most of which were outside of our control. You know, our childhoods were mostly outside of our control. You know, much of our cultural conditioning was mostly outside of our control, and we did not choose it. You know, it is really important that we have sufficient clear comprehension to actually know the roots of some of the sankharas that now beset us. You know, whether it's anxiety or need for approval or, you know, jealousy or comparing or judgment. But I think, you know, in our culture, I think many of us are kind of reasonably psychologically, emotionally literate. You know, most of us have done enough investigation or even, you know, 30 years of therapy. And we actually know how we came to be where we are now. You know, it's not a mystery anymore. It's kind of at our fingertips. You know, we may not be at peace with it all, but we do know how conditions have coalesced actually to imprint upon us, you know, a sense of self and the kind of sankharas that really move us. But we also need to know the point when actually we have enough clear comprehension, you know, and we've done the investigation and we've told the story and retold the story, you know, 1,000 or 10,000 times, and really there's no more learning from it. It's kind of making peace sometimes that there's no more learning from it. You know, there's no mysteries, there's no secrets, there's, you know, it's not covered over. We actually know this. You know, it doesn't mean that the knowing ends the patterns, but we know it. And maybe we're also at a place when we can stop blaming ourselves or others, knowing that they too are an offspring of their conditions and their processes. And maybe then we're at a place where we can actually turn towards some of these most afflictive patterns, you know, without shame and without judgment, simply as knowing that these are the pathways that have become established, and now they're habits, you know? now their psychological and emotional habits, and really there's maybe no more investigation to be done, or no more, you know, information to be gleaned. You know, I'm going back to the gum chewing metaphor, you know. We know it, and now we know we actually need to know the ways to actually step out of the grip of the habit patterns and not volunteer for suffering. Because it's very important to have that clear comprehension, otherwise this tongue against the roof of the mouth business is just about suppressing and repressing and aversion and avoidance. But it is actually possible for us to actually have that resolution that of no longer being governed by that which doesn't serve us well, no matter how historical or how embedded those patterns are. For this, we need the confidence that it's possible for those patterns to be released. But they begin to be released when we stop feeding them. When we stop feeding them. And that's where, you know, the tongue against the roof of the mouth is a kind of metaphor for not going there. You know, just not going there. Not going there. Whatever ways it's possible for me to find to not go there. You know, this is where the real fasting, in a sense, actually begins. And then the Buddha ends this discourse by saying, you know, the mind comes to stillness and to steadiness. And he ends by saying, the mind becomes steadied internally, quieted, brought to singleness and collectedness. This practitioner is then called a master or a mistress of the courses of thought. They will think whatever thought they wish to think when they wish to think it. And they will not think any thought that they do not wish to think. They have severed craving, flung off the fetters, and with the complete penetration of conceit of self, they have made an end to suffering. They have made an end to suffering. So here the Buddha is really describing, isn't it, a mind that's truly a friend and truly well trained. I think the thoughts I want to think when I wish to think them. And I don't think the thoughts I don't wish to think or that don't serve me well. There is actually that choice and that sense of possibility. And they have severed craving. They have severed craving. They've taken away the fuel of that proliferation. Taking away the fuel of that proliferation and come to the end of suffering. And then, of course, the bhikkhus were very satisfied and delighted. Okay, so this is where we're going to end, at least with this investigation today. We will end with a sitting, but are there any questions? Yes, please.
Attitude comes to mind as you talk about dealing with an unwholesome thought pattern, and you say, okay, I'm like over here. I imagine you don't want to do it in person.
Absolutely not, because you're absolutely remembering the context of this, that we're actually putting kindness and compassion and relinquishing or unbinding alongside craving, ill will, and clinging. So attitude is always crucial. It is actually the bringing to bear of those capacities, and if you call them sankharas, bringing to bear those capacities in the midst of all of these efforts. It's important that these efforts are never separated from those kind of foundations of metta and compassion and generosity.
Even when
I put my tongue against the roof of my mouth with such kindness and compassion and generosity that it's the best sensation ever. Hmm? Yeah. This is number 20 in the middle length sayings, and I know you can't access all the discourses on access to insight, but many of them you can.
I'm confused with the above statement you made. Like you said, there is no me. And the confusion is then in the love eyes, and I'm going to do this. And I'm wondering what the I is, what is doing all of this? If there's no me.
No, there is a you, and that's good news. Yeah. Means you go home to the right house and get in the right bed and, you know, raise the right children. There is a you, and there is this is good news. But the Buddha never taught no self. He always taught non-self, and actually he spoke about self in two different ways. He spoke about self as Sakaya Ditti, which is personality view. And this is basically the sankhara of the moment, you know. I'm jealous, I'm impatient, I'm angry. This is basically Sakaya Ditti. It's the personality view of the moment that it is subject to change, although it will often fall in repetitive pattern views that are available because they've been repeated so often. But the Buddha is very clear that this personality view is entirely reliant upon identification. It's the selfing of the moment. It's the selfing of the moment. Okay, and the other way that he speaks of self is in terms of mana, which is much more hidden. And this is referred to as the conceit of self. But actually it's the relational positioning of self, which is far more hidden and often, but does shape personality view. If I see myself as being better than you or inferior to you or the same as you. So the Buddha is actually really, what he's actually pointing out is that none of this has any independent self-existence, that there's no enduring, reliable, reified, solid me that can be trackable moment to moment, you know, that it is a constantly changing phenomenon of selfing. So the Buddha is actually concerned with actually the views of self that are actually built upon the sankharas of greed, hatred, and delusion. You know, that this is actually what causes suffering. You know, it causes me no suffering at all actually to know my name and my address. This is absolutely just fine, you know, and it would be quite dysfunctional, but more than dysfunctional, there's actually great dangers in terms of thinking of no self, you know, because first of all, it would mean we would have no ethical compass, we would not feel responsible for our actions and our way of being in the world, and it speaks much more of a kind of an annihilation rather than a cultivation. You know, so it is very important to be quite clear on that. The Buddha was only interested in transcending suffering, you know, in uprooting and bringing suffering to an end. He wasn't interested in annihilating this very practical navigational self, which actually makes you unique and makes you creative and makes you able to live, you know, a full and loving and caring life in relationship to others, which is hopefully quite important in our path. But he was talking about taking away the sources of suffering. Yeah.
Yeah. Just going off what you said, is an accurate description then of the self you're describing, the ongoing processes experience.
But the Buddha was actually very concerned with the very with, you know, and I absolutely abhor the expression, but I'm not going to use it. Healthy personhood, I might call it. Healthy people. Healthy, fulfilled people. And that's, you know, when I was referring to earlier, like the seven treasures. These are how we build a healthy personness. You know, we don't have a right word for it in English, you know. But you know, the sense of confidence, the kindness, the compassion, the integrity, the self-respect, you know, born of integrity. All of this is part of kind of a flourishing human being, you know, who lives without regret and who lives without shame, you know, and who is creative and alive and relational. And the Buddha's really concerned with the cultivation of this, you know, not with just some sort of dried out husk of a me, you know, that I've thrown to one side, but actually with people who thrive. He was really concerned with this. This was kind of really at the heart of his teaching, you know, finding a way as a person to thrive without a fixed me. And thriving, you know, relies a lot upon our willingness to embrace the reality, to stop arguing with the unarguables, to embrace the realities of change and to embrace the realities of dukkha and loss and sadness and grief, and but also to embrace the part where, you know, the more self-inflicted wound that comes through greed and hatred and delusion. But through that understanding, to really thrive as a human being.
I keep returning to the initial simile of the fire extinguisher. And in this last sutta, and if it still arises, it seems like maybe it's a sort of turning the nozzle closer and closer to the base of the
yes,
fire.
To avidya, to the distortions. Absolutely. It's almost like you can almost see how we sort of go through layers, don't we? And the most obvious layer that we look at is actually the hindrances, which are, please, not meditative issues. They are life issues. You know, they are our most obvious sign of discontent and distress is the hindrances. You know, and then we begin to actually to be more skillful with the hindrances, less captivated by them, less gripped by them. And we see underneath them, you know, there's a new layer, you know, and here's these kind of like really core patterns of greed and hatred and confusion. And underneath that, oh, why is there greed, hatred, and delusion? It's not like we like them or love them or want them. Why is there greed, hatred? Oh, because there's these distortions in actually how we're seeing. So yes, the nozzle of the fire comes closer and closer. The base keeps getting more and more. It's a shifting landscape.
I'm thinking that the longer one of these sankharas is given free rein, the more momentum it picks up.
Oh, absolutely.
And so if you're trying to point the nozzle here and there at the whipped flames and not getting down there at the base, you're losing valuable time.
They certainly do, and, you know, it is one of the reasons why to practice, because, you know, it seems that aging and well-practiced sankharas don't go well together.
So you get urgency.
There's a little ardency needed here, yes. Yes, if you've ever been around a person who's, you know, practiced anger their whole life. You know, and the resources decline in terms of their ability to restrain or meet that rage. It's very difficult. It's afflictive for everyone. Okay, I think we should take just 5 minutes to stand up and stretch, and then we'll end the day with just a short sit.